Public Defender's Office. Say again?
28.
Both of them.
Good afternoon, Representative Springer, members of the committee. My name is Michael Bailey. I'm the Assistant Director of Metropolitan Public Defender in Portland. And I supervise the Portland office. With me on my immediate left is Stephen Jacobson, who is the training director for the Public Defender's Office. And on my right, Chris Cornwaye, who is employed by us as a staff felony attorney. We all three have brief remarks to address the committee. I'll ask Mr. Jacobson to begin, please.
I think the first thing to say, members of the committee, is that from a defense perspective, the problems that were talked about by all the proponents of these bills are problems which we agree are problems. That child sex abuse is something that's prevalent in society. It's something that needs to be dealt with. It is being dealt with in many ways, by education in schools, by education generally, by treatment, by prosecution, by all the things that have been talked about. Specifically, though, what we're dealing here with is two specific ways that are really very similar of changing statute of limitations on criminal prosecution. I would argue that is an incorrect solution to the problem that people have been saying exists, and that I do agree exists. The policy for statute of limitations is that prosecutions, there's lots of policies. The main one is that prosecutions should be based on some kind of reasonably fresh evidence. That's the commentary to the Model Penal Code on which our law is based, says that is the number one reason. There can be several underlying reasons for this. One of the most important is that if you're going to prosecute people, you should be able to give them a fair trial. You do not want to convict innocent people. Now, this is not something that's been talked about very much up to this point. But if you have charges that are based on evidence that is so stale that there is no way to defend against it, and if there is a possibility that the charge itself is incorrect, then you're going to astronomically increase the possibility of having people convicted who are not guilty of the charges. Now, if you have a statute of limitations, the amount of time that you pick is somewhat arbitrary, as the speakers have indicated. But basically, you want to try to get these cases tried when you're dealing with evidence that you can test in a court of law and that you can try to have some corroboration through witnesses about what happened, what was going on at the time of the charges. If you begin to deal with these kinds of charges, where the allegations are coming up 6, 7, 8 years later, even 4 or 5 years later, it's going to be impossible, other than word of one person against another, to try to determine what happened.
Excuse me, Representative Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The way that you're going here, I mean, now, are you saying that you don't think the trier fact is going to be fair in these cases? Are you saying this is so emotional that they're not going to be fair?
I think the triers of fact are always going to be try to be fair. What I'm saying is that the policy behind the statute of limitations, the reason why you, at some point, cut off the possibility of prosecutions, one of the reasons is that it becomes impossible to have a fair trial in the sense that nobody can get evidence. All you're dealing with is an allegation and a denial. You're not dealing with any other evidence.
But that's, I mean, I guess that would be the same in a murder trial, too.
I think it would be very, very unusual in a murder trial that would be the case. In a murder trial, you're dealing with a complete investigation that surrounds what happens at the time of the murder. Witnesses come in, you can deal with with motive, opportunity, alibi, you know, any kind of defenses that are there. You're talking about something that happened 5-6 years ago, happened on one occasion or during the course of a week or a month. It's impossible. Yes?
I'm just saying you're getting right to the integrity of the entire system is from what you're saying, and I think that the trier fact can make that the distinction. I understand what you're saying. It's just that I don't see why these cases would be any different from any other in the question, the issues that are going to be put before a trier fact.
The cases will be made different if you do away the statute of limitations, and that you will get older and older and older charges prosecuted than you have now. The older the charge, the more difficulty there is in producing any evidence about what went on other than one person's word against another.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Okay.
I believe Mr. Bailey is going to talk about some of the statistics that we have in our office in defending these cases now. I think those, perhaps the things that he talks about will address some of the issues that you've raised. Let me give you one example of a case. I don't believe it's over with, so I'm not going to use the names. But we've got a case that, within the statute of limitation as it now exists, there's an allegation that one incident of sexual abuse occurred within a year period of time, approximately 2 years ago. But it's alleged from this date, 1981, to this date, 1982. And the assumption is that it was hard for, it only occurred once, and the victim can't remember the exact date. At least that was the allegation at the beginning of the case. Then the defense is told, well, it happened on this particular day in 1982. At least this is what we think. Defendant says, first of all, defense says, I never did this. This is a false charge. And once the date is given, you go out and investigate. You find out the person was out of the state on that date. So you present that evidence to the prosecutor who's trying to decide whether or not they have a valid case. Once that is presented, then the prosecutor comes back, goes back, talks with the person who's made the report, and they come up with another date. This has happened 3 to 4 times on one case where the person who is claiming that they're being falsely accused can't defend themselves because what they're dealing with is something that's so old, the evidence is so stale, it's so hard to pin these things down as opposed to a murder where you know when it happened, you know what happened, that it becomes difficult to defend. And if you don't believe that anybody is ever falsely accused of crimes, then this shouldn't, you know, the statute of limitations bill shouldn't be any problem because then you're only going to be prosecuting guilty people. Our experience as defense lawyers is that not all people are guilty. An awful lot are, an awful lot plead guilty, an awful lot are convicted at trial, but there are some people who are not guilty, who are innocent, and who deserve a defense. By extending the statute of limitations, you're going to bring in a lot more of those kind of people into the criminal justice system. Those kind of people aren't going to have a very decent chance of defending themselves against a charge that was 5 or 6 years old, as opposed to if the report were made in the recent past and they can show what they were doing at that time.
Representative Hill.
It just seems the other side of it, that would be harder for the prosecutor. I mean, the burden of the person is still innocent until proven guilty, and it would seem that the prosecutor would have a difficult time with a case like that as well.
It may be that they will, and it may be that they're not going to have great success in prosecuting them. And I think that goes to some of Mr. Berkland's remarks, that it would be a very unwise use of prosecutorial and police resources to go after cases that are this old, that if people are reoffending, as it appears from a lot of the studies that people do reoffend, you take a case that's more recent, you prosecute those cases. If nothing's happened in 5 or 6 years, not only is it hard to determine what did happen, but it becomes may be unnecessary process.
Mr. Chairman, let me say one thing, and I will just cut off and let the gentleman proceed. I guess my concern, what I'm saying is that juries are given difficult cases all the time in many areas, and we have to presume that they're going to do the right thing. That's the heart of our system. And so I would assume that they could do the same thing in these cases, regardless of how difficult they are, and I think they could sort it out. That's my only point.
Well, I agree that the jury system is a good system and that they would try to sort it out. What I'm saying is that you're going to end up with less evidence, as the statute of limitations purpose is to get cases with fresh evidence. If you don't have fresh evidence, there's less good chance of the system working, no matter what the intentions and abilities of people. I think I'll end my comments here, Mr. Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Jacobson. Just, I'd like mostly, with your permission, Representative Springer, to address myself to 2087, but just following up a minute on Mr. Jacobson's comment, Representative Hill, I carry one of these little critters around with me all the time, and you probably do too. You're a lawyer, I know that, and we keep records here, but I'm surprised at how few of my indigent clients have the clue as to where they were 2 years ago today, let alone six. And when you start to extend the statute of limitations, and the allegation is that on an elevator in 1979, you grabbed a little girl's behind, which is a crime in this state, and you try to figure out where you were that day, I think some serious due process implications arise. I did ask to share with the committee some statistics on child sex cases. I do not portend that these are complete. The reason is I was only able to run the crime of sex abuse in the first degree, the cases that we have received from July 1 of 1983 through March the 4th of this year. These 56 cases are all cases that were indicted under 12, so there's no forcible compulsion here. These are all child cases. We were appointed on 56 cases of under 12 during that period of time. Of those cases, a total of 40% were convicted of the charge. That includes 30% who pled guilty, 4% who were found guilty by a jury, and miscellaneous others stick to the facts, no contest, please. Interestingly, 42% of the cases resulted in jury findings of not guilty, guilty of misdemeanors, or were dismissed for various reasons by the prosecutor's office. And then other cases were disposed of in other ways. But right now, we're at about a standoff, it looks like, with 40% convicted of the charge, 42% acquitted, dismissed, or convicted or pled to misdemeanors. I have a lot of problems with 2087, which is the right, basically, to confrontation of a victim under the age of 10. I won't belabor you with the philosophical problems of hearsay, except to say that I was a deputy prosecutor in Multnomah County and was the chief assistant deputy for 3 years from 1971 to 1974. I practiced privately for 6 years. I've been a public defender for nearly 5 years. So for 15 years of my life, I've been engaged actively in either the prosecution or defense of cases, and I, as a prosecutor, certainly had a number of experiences that have come to my mind in anticipation of this testimony, where victims at the last minute told me they were lying, and where I dismissed cases. Now, I have no scientific evidence to present to you as to whether the statement to a mother or father of a young person is inherently reliable, but that notion is certainly contradictory to my own experience. And I want to end my comments by relating to you a case, the facts of a case that I tried in the Multnomah County Circuit Court on February the 6th of this year. My client was charged with sex abuse on his stepdaughter, who was age 10. This offense occurred in June of 1984 and was promptly reported. My client was arrested within 48 hours. Now, the problem is this. If you read those police reports, you find some rather lurid testimony that my client allegedly put his finger in the vagina and in the anus of this 10-year-old girl, committed other acts on her. But if, as I read those police reports between the lines, what I was seeing is that this is mother providing these details, and all the little girl ever does is agree with what her mother's saying. Now, unfortunately, under the provisions of 2087, she could have been an unavailable witness, the victim, because there was corroborating evidence, to wit, a medical report which summarized a redness, chafing, and swelling of the vaginal area of this 10-year-old child. Now, we were never able to talk to that child, but mother initiated contact with us several times and continued to fill in the details. Now, I don't want to belabor this particular case, but I want to tell you that I went to see the doctor who told me that the redness was as likely caused by self-stimulation or a minor urinary tract infection with this child had as it was by the sex abuse. At trial, my client had the right under the law of this state to confront this 10-year-old girl. And ladies and gentlemen, any trial lawyer who will go into court and beat up on a 10-year-old kid in front of a jury, yell at them and frighten them, is not going to win that case. That's the worst trial tactic in the world. If that's the kind of scare story you're worried about, it doesn't happen. That's not how you win cases. You speak gently to a sex abuse victim and you try to get her to tell you the truth. The deputy prosecutor and I both treated that child with kid gloves, and what did we find out? We found out that my client had placed his hands on this little girl's lower back and never had his hands inside her underpants. We found out that he rubbed her tummy watching television, as he had done every night for 3 years since he'd been married to her mother. This was nothing but a beef between that mother who wanted to get rid of my client. At the end of that child's testimony, the deputy prosecutor was satisfied that my client was innocent and refused to present any additional testimony, and the case resulted in a directed judgment of acquittal of an innocent person. This isn't a case where I did a legal loophole. My client did not commit those acts. Had this case gone to the jury without that little girl's testimony, but with her mother and the medical report, I submit to you that my client probably would have been convicted of sex abuse, which is probably the worst label that you can put on a human being in our society. And so I want to caution the committee as it deals with this very serious problem that to us this is not a joke, the idea of convicting innocent people. And I don't think we're going to get to where we want to be, a safe and mutually respectable society, by making it easier to get these convictions and by dealing with something as basic as the right to confront. If I hadn't had that child in court, my client would have been convicted. When it comes to 2087, I hope you'll think long and hard about that.
Okay, why don't we take the other testimony and then we'll see if there are any questions.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Chris Cornwaye, and as was indicated, I work for the Public Defender's Office as a trial attorney. I've worked there for the last 4 years, and probably in the last 2 years, I've handled as many sex cases as any other attorney in that office, if not any other attorney in public in Multnomah County. And I've had an occasion to try a number of cases, some of them involving children, some of them involving adults. We each have our horror stories about the cases that were found not guilty, where you know in your heart that your client is not guilty. You go to trial on the hope that the system functions. You stand there at trial realizing that you've got 12 people in a jury that can think of nothing more abhorrent than an adult raping or sodomizing or sexually abusing some small child, knowing full well that the judge shares that opinion of abhorrence for that act, and knowing full well that you are standing in the breach between a system that is about to convict this man because he's so accused, and hoping that the system actually will function and that truth will come to the surface. Now, in any case that you handle, you've got the same set of circumstances. And in response to Representative Hill's comments, the system does function generally. It does function well generally. But the toughest case that I can think of defending is a sex case, for reasons that are clear to all of us if we think about it. And those reasons are that we all have the same emotional response to that charge. We probably also share some common feelings about what is appropriate as a result when someone is convicted of that offense. We've heard almost everyone say that the individual should receive treatment, that the individual should be taken off the streets and to some degree kept from being a continuing danger to other individuals in the community. defense bar, prosecution bar, judges, no one would disagree with that. But the question is, are we going to tamper with the system that determines guilt or innocence in these crimes? And I would suggest to you as a trial lawyer with some experience in these areas that already there's no more difficult job than defending an individual on these charges. And we may all think, well, if the person is guilty, that's just fine. That's exactly the way it should be. We want to make sure that individual is convicted. But think about the case where the individual is not guilty and he's had that onus placed upon him. And usually it is a him. Usually it's a stepfather. Usually it's a broken home. Usually it's a situation where the father's no longer in the home. There's animosity between the adults in that situation. The child could easily pick up on that animosity, especially when the mother continues to drill into the child the hatred for the father. There's all kinds of reasons that kids lie. You'll hear testimony, I'm sure, that kids don't lie, that they're too naive, that this and that. Kids become much more educated and sexually aware at much earlier ages right now than they ever did when any of us were children. And any of us could be a juror in these cases. I'll limit my points. I'll limit the histrionics. The point I want to make is that the most difficult case you can defend is a sex case. And the system is a very, very delicate balance as it stands. The balance is already tipped to a certain extent in these kinds of cases to the prosecution. And it's tipped in the following ways. One, the emotion. The jury and the judge share it. The prosecution shares it. They prosecute these cases with a zeal that probably isn't imitated in any other kind of case that they prosecute, for the same reasons we all respond the way we do to these cases. The other reason is Rule 412 of the Oregon Evidence Code, which prohibits the use of prior sexual acts in cases of sexual nature. If you've got a child that's previously been molested, or been molested by other kids in the neighborhood, or been found involved in sexual activity with other kids in the neighborhood, the jury doesn't hear those kinds of things because of Rule 412 as a general rule. You've got a hand tied behind your back when you walk into a trial if you can't lay the entire scenario, the entire factual background to the jury to let them make a decision. And now the prosecution wants to be able to extend the statute of limitations so that they can bring in incidents that supposedly had occurred but are more remote in time. I suggest to you that the system is already fairly functioning in these kinds of cases because of the emotion that's involved in them. And we should be very, very careful in doing anything that's going to upset that balance. The cases that you win as a defense attorney in these kinds of trials, in sex trials, are clean wins. If you've been lucky enough to defend somebody successfully in a sex case, you know very well that, first of all, you're extremely lucky because of the uphill battle that you've got to fight. And I can tell you that I've won a number of cases, a number of trials, and in each trial, I have felt absolutely relieved because I have known that my client was not guilty before I went into that trial, and my only hope was I was going to be able to show it. And I didn't know that I would be able to do that under the existing rules. We're talking about changing the statute of limitations, and we're talking about changing the right to confront witnesses. I'll give you one more story. The first sex case that I tried was involving a white male, age 35, and a small child, age 11. There was supposed to be a history of sexual abuse between this adult's stepfather and this child. The mother hated the father. They had been separated for about 3 years. I had no doubt in my mind that based on the medical testimony that was available, that the child had been sexually molested. The statement from the child was that, well, is daddy gone? Is he coming back? When the child was assured that daddy was not coming back, the child said to the parents, no, to the mother, that daddy had abused her, and that she wanted to go to the doctor. The father had been out of the home for approximately 3 months, and the child felt comfortable pinning it on somebody that wasn't going to be around, maybe because the child was afraid of the father, or maybe because that was just an easy person to pin the blame on. The reason I bring up this story is that in that situation, it turned out the child had been abused, continued to be abused, and at the time that she reported the incident, the medical report showed that there was still some redness around the child's vaginal cavity. We were able to show through medical testimony that at the time that redness occurred, it would have been impossible for that to be the result of the father being involved sexually with that child 2 months previously, and that the father had been down in California for the 2 months prior to that incident. The child also said, well, on this particular day, when mommy was in the hospital, that's when daddy did it to me last. And that, again, was 2 months before father left for California. She needed a date to pin it to. When we were able to put that child on the stand and confront her, and I don't mean confront in a negative sense, there's never been any tenderer handling of a child on the stand. And as Mr. Bailey has indicated, that will always be the way that you approach these cases, because you don't want to further victimize someone in front of a jury. It's not to the best interest of your client. You put the child on the stand, you talk to that child, and we spent about 2 hours talking. The lights were dimmed in the courtroom. The setting was very comfortable for the child, or made as comfortable as possible as the courtroom can be. And we went through the entire weekend that this was supposed to have occurred. And at the end, the question too many, as many defense lawyers would say, was, well, you've given us this entire weekend. When did your stepfather sexually abuse you? And the child was only able to say, I don't know. The jury came back not guilty in that case. The case illustrates two points. If the child hadn't taken the stand to testify in front of that jury on that occasion, if the hearsay had been allowed, if the mother had been allowed to testify to accuse the father, we never would have gotten the truth from that child. And the second point is that it was the proximity of the incident to the charges being brought that allowed us to bring out adequate testimony of an alibi that the father couldn't have been around at the time. Don't mess with the system. We all feel the same way about sex cases. We all know they're heinous acts. But there's one thing more heinous, and that is falsely convicting someone of this crime. And I would suggest to you that if you think about what it is to be falsely convicted of a crime like this, and to carry that onus with you for the rest of your life, to do the hard time that you would do in a penitentiary, having the label of a child molester, and then take it one step further and think about what that child would feel several years later when the child matures enough to realize that she or he has given testimony that resulted in the false conviction of a loved one or a person, an individual, you are creating more victims by tampering with the system. You must leave the system intact. You must protect the integrity of the trial system.
Okay, Representative Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
When prosecution is delayed over a period of time, who does that benefit, or who does that benefit the most, the prosecution or the defense? See, my understanding is that the longer you have to wait, it makes the case more difficult to prosecute. Witnesses disappearing, things just becoming stale. And I guess I need to know from you, how does that make your job more difficult?
What I'm suggesting to you is that you are correct in stating that there's a presumption of innocence in criminal cases.
Right.
It is something that we all speak about. But that presumption is a much, much thinner one when you're dealing with this kind of case because of the emotional appeal the charge has. People have to get through their own emotional response to the charge before they can be objective about the facts of the case. So you're already fighting an uphill battle as a defense attorney in this case. As far as the delay goes, it's difficult for both sides because you're not able to prove what happened long time ago. You can't get the witnesses around. In these kinds of cases, characteristic of these kinds of cases is that there are not a lot of witnesses involved.
How does that hurt the defense to have to wait?
I'll compose my remarks. Mr. Bailey said he had a response. I'll let him intercede.
Okay.
Well, Representative Hill, I see a big difference here between, let me give you an example, a bank robbery case. I just did one, all right? The money blows up, and I got ink all over my hands. Now, obviously, as a defense attorney, the longer the time passes between the time the heat gets on my hands and the time I get busted, the better off for the defense. No question about that. Or I've got some marijuana, and 6 years goes by and the marijuana dries up and it goes away before a valid lab test can be conducted on it. In those kinds of cases, I think the best thing a defense attorney can do is put skids to the case. I agree with you. However, this case, as Mr. Cornway just said, sex abuse is something that happens between me and the victim. Now, I got a six-year-old victim, let's say. And on an occasion in 1979, we were alone together for 3 or 4 hours. Now, 6 years later, when this child is 12, I'm being asked to defend myself based on an event that I probably don't remember at all, but may be a big deal in her mind. But I'm saying in this kind of case, it doesn't rot on the vine because there's nothing there except your testimony and this other person's testimony. When you try to start figuring out where you were in March of 1979, it makes it a lot more difficult to defend an old sex abuse case than it does an old bank robbery case or an old drug case or an old conspiracy case, because there's never anything involved. I shouldn't say never. 90% of the time, there's nothing involved except the victim's word against yours. The sooner you get a chance to defend yourself, the better off you're going to be. There's nothing to get stale in this case. The older the victim gets, the better witness she becomes.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hill.
Now, you mean to tell me that a jury is going to, well, if a case is very old, that a jury is not going to take into consideration that that's an old case?